Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is in the Philadelphia suburbs near King of Prussia, which is known for its mall, but also importantly known for its history with Valley Forge and being an important part of our country from day one. And if you've been listening to the podcast, you know I've been talking to people who have run for office or are running for office from across this country, from the Philly area to New Jersey and New York and Massachusetts, all the way out to Nevada and Montana and a lot of places in between. Today, I'm excited to talk to my first guest from North Carolina. The last person I recorded was from South Carolina. So if you listen to both, you can determine what is your favorite Carolina. But I think today might turn out really well. I'm excited to chat with someone who we have a lot in common with, which I didn't know when I first started tweeting with him. His name is Pierce Freelon, and he's running for state legislature in North Carolina. So, Pierce, thank you for joining the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you are in Durham, North Carolina.
Yep.
Before you tell me about Durham, tell me about a little bit about yourself. We always talk about what gets people interested in politics. Have you always been political in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I was raised in a family that was very engaged in the community, so I don't know if we would have called it, politics specifically, definitely a part of several communities that were involved in organizing work and activism, art, and different aspects of movement work. Durham is a very... it's a educated city. There's a lot of universities in this area, in the Triangle area. And there's a very kind of diverse community. Durham, for a long time, has just an old, strong black community that goes back to the early 1900s. They used to call it Black Wall Street. So unlike other areas in the South, there's a long history of black political, economic power here. And so folks are engaged. We've had black folks in city council and just across the spectrum in our political culture here in North Carolina. And I think probably one of my earliest memories, specifically getting involved in politics, was probably when Harvey Gantt was running against Jesse Helms in the 90s. My dad, who was an architect, was a supporter of his colleague. Harvey Gantt was the first black mayor of Charlotte. He was coming from a design background as an architect and an engineer. So they were colleagues as architects. And then when Harvey got into politics, my dad was there to back him up doing fundraisers at the house. I was got involved in the campaign, knocking on doors and support, stickers and buttons and all that. That was probably my first exposure as a young person to a, big political race. But,
and how old were you then? You were probably pretty young then, right?
Yeah, I was born in 1983, so I was probably, I don't remember the year, it was probably, nine during that first run, or, mm-hmm. 11. I was in the 90s, and I was in middle school at the time. So, I've got vivid kind of memories of my dad and Harvey kind of rallying together against what at the time was a really big political force in North Carolina. Jesse Helms was a prominent member of the Republican Party. He was a senior in our state, in our U.S. Senate, and was a very controversial figure. He was,
he was like the face, I don't want to say genteel face, but he was like the Senate face of racism and hate, right?
Yeah, I mean, he came out of that Jim Crow era, and was, leader this kind of conservative wave. And he was just a long standing. He was in there for, you know, I think 30 years. So it was really bold for a young black architect, mayor, to challenge this very well-established, well-funded, you know, loved and reviled figure in North Carolina politics. And I really, I admired Harvey Gantt a lot and the way that he ran his campaign. And he got close. He got really close.
Yeah, I was looking up that race. He got like 47% of the vote, which, considering the background where he's coming from and everything, that is a very close race against a long-term incumbent, no matter where you are.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Jesse Helms was somebody who, he was a leader in the state, but he was a leader fighting against civil rights, fighting against, you know, LGBT rights and affirmative action. And, you know, it was really an important race to, well, no pun intended, but, you know, again, for a black man, first black mayor of Charlotte, we've never had a U.S. senator of African descent in this state, you know, and we're in the South. This is below the Mason-Dixon line. It's, you know, the Klan is still active here. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a Klan rally in Hillsborough, about 20 minutes from my house. So imagine what that must have been like in the 90s, you know, for Harvey to come out of the, not the Deep South, but, you know, a deeply red state, at least in that, at the U.S. Senate level.
I can only imagine, like you said, the boldness and really the bravery of being a political force when you're black in that kind of environment, both then and today. Like, it, you feel, you know, as me being removed from it, as a liberal white man in Philly area, and then you living it, it's different perspective. But, like, that's a force to be up against. That's something that you're, you know, that this is a dangerous potential thing to do, and I'm impressed with yourself, your dad, and Harvey for taking those steps and hopefully inspiring others.
Yeah, I mean, I think black folks in this country don't have, we don't have a whole lot of option other than to be bold if we want to be treated as equals. And I think, I just think back, you know, not just to the brave and courageous freedom fighters of, you know, that were fighting against larger institutions like enslavement or Jim Crow. You know, the sit-in movement launched out of North Carolina, right, in Greensboro, for college kids at North Carolina A&T, just got up in the face of, you know, systematic apartheid and decided to sit down at a lunch counter that was illegal for them to do. That took a lot of bold guts. And, you know, and the sit-in movement, though, it kind of sparked nationally out of Greensboro. It was preceded by a sit-in 3 years prior in Durham at the Royal Ice Cream Shop. And was even in the SNCC. There's an organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was kind of like the younger wing of the, you know, King and the SCLC and the NAACP. You know, this kind of younger wing of black political organizing and movement. It started in Raleigh at Shaw University. So there's just, you know, I think that there are plenty of examples of people who aren't just bold to be bold. They're bold for the, because their survival depends on it, and they're being treated as an equal citizen, American, depends on them to be bold and to fight injustice with methodical precision and sometimes reckless abandon. So it gives me confidence to know that I have ancestors who were so courageous to, you know, to kind of know what my responsibility is when it's my turn to lead.
So we can go into a long history of North Carolina, I'm sure, and you would teach me a lot, but you know, you're becoming a leader now in Durham, and you know, just to a disclaimer alert, my brother-in-law who's from Rhode Island, lives in Brooklyn. Him and his wife are moving to Durham. They have a house they bought there. They're planning to move into, so it must be a good place. But Durham is a little bit different than before. What makes Durham special now?
Well, I think Durham is, you know, it's a special city for a lot of reasons. We, as I mentioned, have this heritage going back 100 years of black entrepreneurship, which is just can't be underscored how rare that was for Southern City to have the first black-owned bank, the first black-owned insurance company in the world. We're here in Durham. There were, you know, black millionaires here. The only place to go get a loan in a 500-mile radius was this city. So people came from all over. And when you think about where Durham is now, you can't really be separated from that history and that legacy. You know, North Carolina Central University, which is a historically black college, you know, founded with James Shepard and some of the guys who founded Black Wall Street, Shepard, Merrick, they were also will go on to be instrumental in supporting other black institutions around the city that still exist today, you know, such as North Carolina Central University. And we're surrounded, we're flanked in this state. We're really, really lucky. There are more historically black colleges in the state of North Carolina than anywhere else in the country. And Durham's got one of the nicest ones. We've also got Duke University, which is like, you know, Ivy League caliber, you know, great research institution, a great basketball program. North Carolina Central has one of those as well. So we've got a great intellectual environment. There's more PhDs in the Triangle area, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, than anywhere in the country except Michigan. I think we're the second or third most educated area in the country. You know, so there's a lot of opportunities for folks to get good jobs here. There's a burgeoning tech sector with a lot of startups. Right in Durham, there's a startup hub called American Underground, which is a pretty amazing incubator for startups. Burt's Bees is based in Durham. You know, we've got a lot of big companies that have put their headquarters in Durham because of the culture, because of the food, because of the history and the legacy, because of the infrastructure. It's just a popular destination, especially as some of these larger markets like Silicon Valley or, you know, Washington, D.C., New York, you know, folks are getting priced out of those areas. They've just been gentrified. And the cost of living is very expensive. So people are looking to, you know, kind of smaller mid-tier cities, you know, close to an international airport, places like Durham, places like Austin, places like Oakland. They're looking to these cities as a space where they can raise a family or start a business or own a home for the cost, for what it would cost to rent an apartment in one of these other bigger cities.
Right, that's why my brother-in-law is moving from New York to there, because there's all this opportunity and energy, and it's a lot more affordable for the space than it is in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and you know, and you have a lot of the same amenities. You've got all, you know, great restaurants, culture, food, festivals, you know, all those things are, you know, very attractive to folks, you know, especially once they start, for example, not only, but for example, when they start thinking about buying a home or starting a family, you're like, do I really want to do this in New York? What is the school situation going to look like? How am I going to figure out kind of a long-term equity situation with an investment in property? You know, but one of the challenges, though, that brings, especially for people who've been living here in Durham for a long time, I was born and raised in Durham, and the housing prices have, you know, my neighborhood on my block where I grew up, you know, have quadrupled in the past 10 years. And, you know, people are moving out of places like Brooklyn because they can't afford it, but they're moving into places like Durham and are making it pretty quickly unaffordable for a lot of the folks who've been here. So it's a tough balance. I mean, I think migration patterns are pretty consistent across the country. You see these mass exodus movements of people out of these tech centers and financial centers like New York and Seattle, and they're going to the closest, coolest place they can find that they can afford. And it's, you know, it's fueling gentrification, but also like expanding our tax bracket and you know, bringing new skills and new jobs and new startups to the community. So it's been a challenge to kind of figure out how to grow sustainably and responsibly, and how to honor the people who've been here while welcoming folks who are coming, flocking even to Durham to make it home. And I think it's really important in that context, especially, that we have thoughtful leadership that are crafting policies and that have a, not just like a social justice, but just a socially conscious, I would say, approach that's not just about kind of bottom lines or just building businesses, but preserving community, preserving legacy, and protecting folks who are vulnerable to some of the changes that are happening.
So why is it that you then are running for state senator? Because I'm sure there are other people who could do it. There's always someone else that I guess could do it. What was the impetus that said, you know, Pierce, I have to do this?
Yeah, there are several reasons. You know, one of the biggest reasons is my dad. He passed away in July of ALS. And I didn't mention this when I was talking about how awesome Durham is, but one of the, when we were kind of prepping for this conversation before you hit the record button, you mentioned that one of the four, you know, foremost ALS researchers and physicians is here in Durham. And Durham is also known as the city of medicine. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, this is an area where one of the big things that distinguishes Durham is all of the hospitals. And there's a lot of medical research happening at Duke and other surrounding institutions. There's a lot of medical research that's happening in Research Triangle Park. You know, there's a lot of pharmaceutical companies just kind of on the edge between Durham and Raleigh and in Morrisville. So anyway, we were really blessed, my dad, to have access to the best care in the world right here in our home. You know, one of the things in the last weeks and months of my dad's life that we talked about quite frequently was the fact that we have yet to expand Medicaid in the state of North Carolina. And it's kind of confounding, like, you know, here's an opportunity to provide health care for over 500,000 North Carolinians. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, I'm privileged to be able-bodied. I've never had like a serious ailment. I have insurance because I'm employed. My dad, same thing. But when he became diagnosed with ALS and started to develop a very, very intimate relationship with the hospital system and with the medical industry as he's attempting to navigate this disease that is very expensive to research and treat. In fact, there is no treatment for it. We began as a family to see very distinctly where some of the disparities were,
yeah,
and what the options were for people that have diseases like ALS but don't have access to healthcare. And then they're having to make decisions between, am I going to do this experimental drug trial or am I going to keep the lights on? Am I going to, you know, pay my college tuition, or am I going to pay these medical bills?
Oh yeah, I've seen so many stories. My mom has MS, and you know, there's treatments for that that come up, and she's like, "Well, if I take that, how much is it going to be long term? Is it worth it? Is it going to be, you know?" There's so many hard decisions, and you know, when you have a family like yours, like you said, with insurance, the what decision you're making is a big difference from someone who is trying to scrape by just in a regular life.
Right. And how do you make such an impossible choice?
Right.
You know, it hurts my heart that we have the opportunity to provide care and that we're choosing, our state legislators are choosing not to. And so, you know, that was a big thing for me. I understood on an intellectual level and on a moral level why these things are important. And then when my dad got hit with this devastating disease, it gave me a front row seat at how dysfunctional the system is. And along with that came a strong sense of obligation to do something about it. And so, you know, it's wild. I was earlier this year decided that I probably wasn't going to be running for political office this year. I ran for mayor in 2017, and running a campaign is a full-time job. It's not something that you can just do in your time off after work, you know, on the side. If you want to run and you want to win and you want to serve, there's a big sacrifice. And I decided earlier this year that with my spare free flex time, I didn't want to be knocking on doors or doing political organizing work. I wanted to do the thing that was most important to me, which is spend time with my dad. And my dad, we talked a lot. He knew that I, you know, from how my campaign went in 2017, he knew that I was interested in politics, that I had a knack for it, that, you know, I'd been building momentum and coalitions and solidarity and building a movement, like a young black millennial political movement. That was what came out of our mayoral campaign. And I know that, you know, I told my dad earlier this year, like, I'm 35 years old. I could run for political office anytime, but my time that I can spend with you is very limited. You know, the disease was escalating, and we knew that we weren't talking years anymore. We were now talking. We had months left with him. But, you know, lo and behold, as we spent intimate time together, as I was one of my dad's primary caregivers, our conversations so often went into politics. Again, not just Medicaid expansion, but, you know, criminal justice, education, marijuana decriminalization, gerrymandering. Like, it was a topic of conversation that, you know, was something that we talked about while I'm sitting next to his hospital bed. And he passed away on July 9th. I took that whole rest of the month off just to grieve and to meditate and reflect. And when I came out of that chrysalis, you know, out of that self-imposed kind of mourning cocoon, I emerged with a sense of righteous indignation and enthusiasm and motivation to make some of the changes that we talked about so intimately happen in our state legislature.
Yeah, and I think it's really impressive listening to you talk about Durham and the things you've learned there, and also looking at the state. It's like you want to bring what you've seen to Durham to the state, and I'm obviously you know this because you're running for state senate in North Carolina. The legislature in North Carolina is kind of notorious for not getting things, for the gerrymandering, and not being the democratic small d, not political, just the democratic place that people aspire to in politics, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's dysfunctional.
Is it dysfunctional, or is it functional in a bad way? Because, like, Mitch McConnell in the U.S. Senate, he's functional. He's just, like, not a good person.
Well, the reason I call it dysfunction is because, there are shady tactics being deployed. There's malicious behavior afoot, and there is an inability for people to dialogue and reach any kind of consensus. I guess you could call that functional. I don't know, in the same way that you can have a functioning alcoholic. it's like,
right.
It's I don't know. Personally, I would call that dysfunctional.
Well, yeah, the way you're describing it sounds more dysfunctional than just functional bad, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess it depends on what your goal is. If it's to legislate, there's not a lot of that happening because there's, it's just a toxic culture. I think that we have a divisive and toxic culture in politics generally, and there's a fractal relationship from the smallest units of people being unkind to one another on social media, being short and curt and cruel in our interactions with each other, in our communities, and then in the halls of our city halls and in our state General Assembly, all the way up to the White House. There is a culture of being unkind and unwilling to listen and to compromise. And I think that that's pretty dysfunctional. Not a lot of stuff is getting done as a result. There are missed opportunities for us to do what legislators are supposed to do, which is serve the people of North Carolina. Just a couple weeks ago, there's this really bizarre, shady situation where, there was a budget passed that the governor vetoed, and our state Congress called basically like a secret meeting on 9/11 while several Democrats were out at a memorial, like remembrance service, and while they had the majority that they needed to overturn the governor's veto, they did it on 9/11, and it's just like, really, like on 9/11, of all the times when you could try to pull a dirty trick, you're gonna do it on a day when many of our legislators are honoring the dead of one of the worst terrorist attacks to befall this country. Like, that's just, it's beyond comprehension how folks can sleep at night with that kind of tricky and just democratic small d kind of tactics at their disposal. But that, again, that's the culture. You know, I've tried to be empathetic and think about what some of the Republicans in our state Congress, what might be going on through their heads. Maybe they're feeling like, I don't know, I really can't. It's a stretch, but maybe they're feeling like, oh, that we got to get past this gridlock. Like, you know, we got to try something. But, you know, my dad used to, you know, talk to me about integrity. That's not something that's not how you do it. Okay, you're frustrated, it's difficult, I can't work with these Democrats, we don't have the supermajority that we enjoyed, you know, 2-4 years ago. And what you have to do is make compromise and start a dialogue and say, all right, we'll give up on this thing so that we can get this thing. That's what's supposed to happen when you have a legislator with people with different ideas in it. You don't tell them, like, look the other way and then kick them in the chest on 9/11. Like, so.
Yeah, I think, you know, you talk about integrity. You know, I see you have two young kids. How old are your kids?
My kids are 9 and 10.
So mine are 5 and 3. And, you know, I already tell my kids, or at least my 5-year-old, about integrity. Like, because he's going to do things, and he's at school and getting involved in activities. I'm like, look, you can only control the type of person you are. Someone else, you don't know their intentions. They might not be trying to be, you know who you're being. And that's important to me as a person, for myself, and as a father, and hopefully for them. Clearly, that's important to you and your family. And kind of what you expect from people who are holding, who have the privilege of holding higher office.
Yeah, I mean, well, one would expect that, in principle, I guess, that someone who is seeking to serve have not even a higher moral standard, just a moral standard. Doesn't have to be higher, just have a conscience, please. It's a pretty low bar, but I think that also is the culture of our politics, because at the highest level, you have people bullying, you have people, you know, name calling and being racist and stereotypical and ableist and homophobic. And that is the standard. So, you know, without succumbing to a desire to retaliate or to employ some of the same tactics that are making my stomach turn, you know, in response to these things, I'm just trying to wrap my head around what a future where we can actually be civil with each other can look like, and to reach consensus and to build, you know, build a body of legislative results instead of dysfunction, and that's what I hope to bring to the state senate when I'm elected in March. I'm going to go ahead and speak that into existence.
So one last thing here, that's what you want to do. Clearly understand why you're running and the issues, the motivations that are really important, but, you know, we talked about a great organization called Run for Something. Why should other people run? Because you can't change North Carolina by yourself. I can't change Pennsylvania by myself. But why should other people listening to your message take that on to do the next step?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to sound a little cliche, but I just, you know, sometimes cliches make sense because they're true. And the cliche that I'm thinking of is, be the change you want to see in the world. And for me, if our politics were full of people who looked and thought like and reflected the values and the principles that I wanted them to, you know, I wouldn't be running. I'd say, great, go. Do your thing. I'll be making music or teaching classes or with my family. Like, the reason it's a sacrifice and it's a service is because you're putting your, you know, whatever personal passions or interests you may have to the side so that you can step up and serve the people of your state. And, you know, I don't see a lot of young candidates. I don't see a lot of candidates of color, specifically of African descent, young black men involved in politics. And that's what I, that's, that is a very particular orientation that I want to see at every level. I want to see diversity. I want to see progressive values. And for, again, I'm just speaking personally for me, but I think this could apply to other folks as well. If you don't see yourself reflected in party leadership, in city council, if you're scratching your head, why are they making these decisions? Why don't they try this? Then one of the options that's available to you is to throw your hat in and to be the change you want to see. And instead of trying to beg your mayor or your state legislator to have some common sense, go be that common sense and, you know, take the leap and make the sacrifice to serve the other people who think like you do and who may also want to see a change in their reality. I think we all have this unique capacity. Oh, my cat's eating my food. I'm at home. Interview from home. That was a very fourth wall breaking moment. But anyway, you know, we have this unique capacity as humans, I think, to manifest realities, to bring things into existence. And it might not be politics for you. Maybe it's political organizing. Maybe it's writing a song. Maybe it's teaching a class. Maybe it's going to a march, or you know, there are a myriad of options available to folks who want to make change. But we need people in political office as well that can stand on values and try to change what's clearly been, like, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of first time folks can be intimidating is this feeling like, oh, I'm not qualified, like I might not have all the experience that an incumbent has. And I would ask anyone to just really think about what the folks with experience have gotten us. And, you know, what they've gotten us is a pretty dysfunctional system. And I think new voices and new perspectives and new energy, people coming from out from new disciplines, intellectuals and artists. We need more of those voices, especially, I think, in politics. We don't just only need lawyers you know, people who've been sitting on commissions and stuff. We need people with different, you know, different orientations. So.
Yeah, for you to be someone who 25 years ago or over 20 years ago as a kid was helping to campaign against Jesse Helms to then turn around and be this change years later for other people. Like, that would be a cool way to reverse that negative legacy into something positive.
Yeah, you know, again, we have to give credit to Harvey for showing, or sorry, let me stop calling him by his first name. That is, my dad would be, son, show your elders some respect. But, you know, when people make bold decisions to step into public life for social justice and for healing and for community, you know, it leaves an impression. It definitely impacted my psyche as a young kid, and it showed me that I could do it too. And I have no doubt in my mind that there are some kids around Durham right now who are watching me very closely and who are seeing themselves reflected in my run. And that is not lost on me at all. In fact, I think that is the very definition of like passing the baton. You know, you have to live in your truth and step into your purpose, and that has, you know, ripple effects that just are really impactful and very important. So I'm grateful for Mr. Gant for laying that foundation, and I'm well equipped to take that torch and sprint with it, finish what he started.
Well, hopefully in 20 years there'll be someone who's going to be telling their kid on some young people, they're looking to the example that Mr. Freelon set back in 2019 and 2020 as an example for what to do next. I appreciate what you're doing, the example you're setting. My thoughts are with your dad, of course, as well. I'm sure he'd be very, very proud of what you're doing. For anyone that's listening, if you want to follow Pierce, you can follow him on Instagram, Pierce Freelon, P-I-E-R-C-E, Freelon, F-R-E-E-L-O-N. Go to freelonfordurham.com, and hopefully my brother-in-law will move down there soon enough so that I can witness the campaign firsthand. But I wish you all the best of luck, Pierce, and the change you're trying to bring.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
And if you're listening, check out past podcasts, and I hope you run for office too.